This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster human unity. We present the history, views, and experiences of the world's vast religious and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, helping listeners gain insight into spiritual beliefs and practices around the world, and to help people find tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. The word liturgy, by definition, comes from a composite Greek word that originally meant a public duty or a citizen service to the community at large. In the Christian church, it refers to worship, a form and arrangement of public worship or a corporate ceremony in which all may participate. Joining us today is the Reverend Dr. Patrick Malloy, Professor of Liturgics at General Theological Seminary, the Episcopal Seminary of New York City. We'll be speaking with Dr. Malloy about the history of the Episcopal Church in America, its Anglican roots and connection, core beliefs, celebrations, and the role of the church as an agent of change in today's society. A former Roman Catholic, Dr. Malloy became an Episcopalian in 1991, the same year he earned his doctorate at Notre Dame. His doctoral dissertation then was centered on Roman Catholics in England when they were forbidden by law to gather for worship and the devotional books they utilized from the 16th to 19th century. He was ordained an Episcopal priest 10 years later. As the rector of Grace Church, a struggling parish in Allentown, Pennsylvania, he witnessed an inspired congregation open an employment agency as part of its social ministry, double the student body of its school for needy children, offer free legal counsel to clients of a food pantry, host day-long marriage and family therapy sessions, and establish GED classes that met in its church all day, every day. All of this, according to Dr. Malloy, is liturgy, which he believes has everything to do with action in the world and with empowerment. Patrick, welcome to the show. Now, you've had a very interesting journey yourself, and I would love to hear about your viewpoints on liturgy and how this came to pass. Why don't you tell us a little bit first about your own journey in the church and among churches?
I'm one of those people who has thought of himself from childhood as destined to be a priest. I was pursuing priesthood in the Roman Catholic Church and was, in fact, ordained a deacon in the Roman Catholic Church. Mm. And then decided in 1991 to leave the Roman Church. And that's when I found, quite by accident really, the Episcopal Church, though I certainly had a great deal of experience with Anglicans before that, having studied in England and having had a great many colleagues at Notre Dame in the doctoral program who were Episcopalians or members of other Anglican churches. I was advised by a friend when I left the Roman Church to go to an Episcopal church in New York, where he thought that I would find especially worship that would be to my liking, and I went, and I've never left. And that was in 1991.
Now, what did you see in that worship service or in that church that inspired you so much with certainty?
Well, Episcopalians and Anglicans in general, I suppose, but Episcopalians are known for careful worship. And I found that the worship at the parish that I attended was indeed careful. And by that, I do not mean fastidious or in any way rigid, but it truly showed care, and it evidenced that the people who were there believed that in their worship they were truly encountering the holy in one another, in the proclaimed word, in the holy food and drink, and so they behaved in a way that was so graceful and dignified that it it easily swept me in. I also sensed in this place a remarkable honesty, a realism, that there was an ability in this particular parish to maintain beauty in worship, honesty in relationships, and preaching that did both, preaching that was remarkably eloquent, but at the same time almost shockingly earthy. So many of the things that I valued were there. And in addition, the Episcopal Church and most of the churches of the Anglican Communion have strayed not too far from the medieval religious urge, the medieval religious tendency that is also embodied in the Roman Church. And so I think that it was familiar to me in a way that perhaps other churches that other than the Roman Church would not have been. So it was easy for me to go there and to feel at home.
Yes, that makes sense. You can still connect with the very sacred, as you say, careful worship in the church, but it has that component of the honesty and relationships that, of course,
yes,
makes a church really alive, and not just not just a tradition per se or a rite, but an actual living congregation.
Yes, I had a sense that in this particular parish, and I find this to be true of the Episcopal Church in general, that they understood the tradition to be something not that they were imitating, but something that they embodied or were carrying forward, so that who they were was certainly in continuity with at least 2,000 years of history, and if we want to include the Judaic history, that too. But certainly they saw themselves in continuity with 2,000 years of history, but didn't see themselves as trapped in any particular place in that history, but instead were seeing themselves as being agents of the tradition moving into the future. And so there was something remarkably alive and real about it. I mean, it didn't seem at all like a museum piece. And oftentimes when people think of tradition, that's, I think, what they think of. They think of traditionalism. And that's not at all the experience that I had in this particular New York City parish. It was the Church of St. Luke in the Fields in New York, which is on Hudson Street.
Oh, yes. Yes, I am. I'm from New York myself and studied theology at Fordham. And during my time there, this is mid-90s, it was a very controversial time. For example, in the Catholic Church, when the Pope at the time, John Paul II, had hauled out the word infallible regarding the ordination of women, and I saw the environment change overnight in the theology department about this and the tension that it caused and the sort of camps that it caused. And there came a lot of trading places, as it were, Catholics moving to the Episcopal Church and the Episcopal priests moving into the Catholic Church, and a lot of motion like that for essentially politicized issues often. I'm wondering if you could speak to the fact that the church, and I'm talking capital C church, is a sort of organic being that also changes as we change, and to touch on where the Episcopal Church came from out of church history, in terms of the Anglican Communion and then in America, and sort of give us a basic background on this changing church.
Yes. Some history would be helpful to make it clear that the church is indeed organic. The claim of the Reformers at the time of the Protestant Reformation, the claim of the Reformers in England, was that the Church of England was the expression of Catholicism, that is to say, of Christianity in England, and that it was integral, and that it did not need the governance of the Bishop of Rome to be an integral expression of the Catholic tradition. And I think that it's very similar to the claim, for example, of the various Eastern churches. You know, the Russian Orthodox Church, is an integral expression of the Church, even though, the Greek Orthodox Church, which is also a valid expression of the Church, does not interfere in the internal workings of that Church.
Right.
And so the claim of the English Reformers, certainly before the death of Henry VIII, was that that there was not a major theological shift in England, but rather there was a political shift that is far more complicated than the story of Henry VIII's divorce would lead one to believe. And so the church, at least in the beginning, continued without much difference from the way it had always been, except the Bishop of Rome had no authority in, for example, the appointment of bishops in England. After the death of Henry, there was a power vacuum when his young and sickly son became king, and that allowed for the influx of what we would call Protestant ideas from the continent, the influence of Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and the great continental reformers, then had an impact on the English church, so that the Reformation then began to be more than a political reformation. It began to be more than just a question of who was in charge, but the theology of the church began to shift. That, of course, then was all brought to a halt with the death of Edward and the enthronement of his sister Mary, who returned the Church of England to under the governance of the Pope of Rome, and then which caused unbelievable strife. And then her sister Elizabeth became queen and decided that some kind of middle way had to be found, in which those people who leaned very strongly toward the continental reform and those who leaned very strongly toward the religion as it existed before the Reformation could find a home together. And we call that the Elizabethan settlement, and largely it made a common prayer as the basis for unity. That in a sense it said that if people in conscience can pray together according to the forms that the Church had adopted in the Book of Common Prayer and its associated volumes, then little more would be expected of them. And the belief being that in those forms of prayer were enshrined the biblical religion and the religion of the ecumenical councils before the church entered into schism. And so it was mainstream standard Christianity as they understood it. Those people then founded a great deal or colonized a great deal of what became the United States. When the United States then became its own independent nation, the very logic by which England separated from Rome, namely that foreign bishops have no right to interfere in the churches of sovereign nations, when America became a sovereign nation, then clearly that logic suggested that that the church in the United States could no longer be part of the Church of England. And so another church then arose, which we have come to call the Episcopal Church, which brought with it the prayer book tradition and the basic ethos of the English church, but was an independent church. And there have been many churches since then that have formed around the world, wherever England has colonized places. And all of those churches now are in a loose confederation called the Anglican Communion of Churches. So that's who we are, and that's how we're related to the other church of the Anglican Communion, not in the way that the Roman Catholic Church is one great church that is to say institutionally around the world, but rather we are an international affiliation of independent national churches.
This is fascinating. I love hearing about the history, especially as we come to the United States and realize that, I haven't heard it quite put the way you just did, but it's so clear that once we're getting ourselves out from under the thumb of the king, it would make sense that being the king is the head of the church, that was going to extend to our church as well,
yes.
Which is fascinating, I think, in American history to explore. And so if the church then here, let's say as you would say, the Roman Catholic Church is reporting ultimately, you know, to the Pope in Rome, who does, I'm just speaking very, you know, basically and generally here, the Episcopal Church in America, what is the structure of it? And then who would be, is there an overseer that would still be perhaps connected to England?
Yes, but not in the same way that the... for example, the bishops of the Roman Church in America would be connected to the Pope in Rome.
Right.
Our structure in many ways is essentially the same structure as the structure of the Roman Church because, of course, it is the structure that evolved early in the Church. And as I said, in England there was not, as there was in many places on the continent, an urge to overthrow all of the aspects of the medieval religion, and certainly there was no urge to overthrow the basic structure of the church. So the church is divided into dioceses, each of whom is headed by a bishop who is elected by the clergy and the laity of the diocese. And in that way, we're very different than the Roman church because we elect our own bishops.
The bishops
Those
are
bishops,
elected, yeah.
Yes, we elect our own bishops. The bishops elect from among their number one bishop who is the presiding bishop, who is the first among equals, does not have a jurisdiction in the same way that the Pope would have, but is in a sense the convener of the group and speaks publicly in the name of the group. The current presiding bishop is Catherine Jeffords Shorey, and Bishop Jeffords Shorey, as you know, her election caused turmoil in parts of the Anglican Communion, in churches that do not ordain women, for example, as priests, let alone bishops, and certainly couldn't imagine having a woman as the presiding bishop or primate or archbishop, depending upon what the particular church would call that lead bishop. So Bishop Jeffords Shorey then has a relationship with all of the other, what we call the primates of the other churches. So periodically she would meet and face-to-face and have other correspondence with the bishops of the other Anglican churches around the world. And then every 10 years, all of the bishops of the church gather in Canterbury at the invitation of the Archbishop of Canterbury for international consultations at what is called the Lambeth Conference,
right.
Which is entirely by invitation. At the last Lambeth Conference, there was one bishop who was among all the Anglican bishops in the world who was not invited, and that's Bishop Gene Robinson, the bishop of New Hampshire. But other than he, all the other Anglican bishops in the world were invited to the Lambeth Conference. And so we do not report to an individual person per se, but the Archbishop of Canterbury serves internationally, in a sense, the same function as Bishop Catherine serves here in the United States. He is the first among equals who does not have jurisdiction except by way of moral authority.
Now, some years ago, I recall, I think it's always been a sort of goal to reunite, for the Roman Catholic Church to somehow reunite the Anglican Communion to itself. And some years ago, there was an attempt again, and apparently it failed only on the issue, as it was said, or publicized at the time, on the issue of the ordination of women priests. But what you're sharing right now also is telling me that it continues to be an issue even within the Anglican Communion, even though they did allow women to be ordained as priests. Again, part of the growing church and changing church. How do you see this evolving in the years to come? Will this be resolved?
Within our communion or between us and the Roman Church?
No. That's a whole other question. I just realized from what you just said that it remains an issue even within the Anglican Communion that women in some churches are ordained priests, but not throughout.
There are the question of whether or not an individual church ordains women to the priesthood is because, as I mentioned, the churches are independent national churches. The decision is entirely up to the national church. And the decisions as they have been made historically in the churches have tended to come in stages. So first there was the decision to ordain ordain women as deacons, for example.
Right.
And then there was the decision to ordain women as priests, and then most recently there was the decision to ordain women as bishops. There, even within the United States, there has been
still
a struggle.
Going in degrees here.
Yes. There is, as time passes, that women are ordained at higher and higher levels of authority.
Yeah,
you got
to break this gently,
church.
I guess. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Right. And I think the reason that women bishops become a particular problem in a way that that women priests don't for many members of the communion is that the bishops around the world do meet together at least once every 10 years.
Right.
And the primates do meet together once every, they meet regularly. And so that members of churches that do not support the ordination of women or bishops in dioceses that do not ordain women are forced at these international conferences to actually confront this in a way that they would not have to confront, for example, a woman who was ordained merely a priest.
Right.
Merely a priest. That's a terrible turn of phrase. I didn't mean that at all. I don't think of myself as being merely a priest, but yes, I think this is an evolving issue that has to be worked out in our church and in the churches.
Yes, and even what you just said in terms of the structure of authority, it's hard, to recall that the original, goal of the priesthood is of any, either gender, is service.
Yes.
These days, it's so associated with authority and who can and who can't. I'm sure it's one of the things many people struggle with in terms of looking at the church, at large and specific churches as well, which sort of brings us to the sort of social role of the church, struggling with the same things, glass ceilings, and yet having the opportunity to set the example. And in many ways, the Episcopal Church and Anglican Communion do take those steps to set the example and move forward and deal with the mess, apparently, because we need to. We need to break those eggs to move forward into our spiritual omelet, as it were. Tell us about your description. When I was describing before about all the acts in the church to help the community economically and otherwise, and you're considering that liturgy. Could you speak a little bit about that? It's a very beautiful analogy. I'm sure our listeners would like to hear a little more about that.
Yes, it seems to me that the primary liturgy, that is to say the primary work of the Christian community, is to be the ongoing presence of the Christ in the world, to be the body of Christ in the world. And I think that is the liturgy of the church. I think what we call liturgy, what we call public worship, mirrors that, is one aspect of that. But if liturgy is simply some ritual that we do, some ceremony that we perform, then I think that we have missed the point, really, that to be a Christian is to embody the living Christ in the world, and to continue Christ's mission in the world. And I think that is our primary liturgy. That is the primary public service to which we are called. And if that's not there, then what we do in church on Sunday, no matter how beautiful or eloquent, is really a sham.
Yes.
So I think that's the living out of
the faith.
Yes. That's right, living out of the faith, because I think that is the basic call of our baptism, is to being grafted into the body of Christ, then to be the body of Christ in the world.
Before we go to we're going to take a short break momentarily, but since you mentioned baptism, can you speak a little bit just about that sacrament? And perhaps when we come back, we'll talk about some other sacraments as well. But the sacrament of baptism and how it works in a person's life that would make it connect, as you just explained, to Christ in the world.
The 1979 Book of Common Prayer, the most recent revision of the Book of Common Prayer in the American Church, places baptism at the center of everything. So that it's clear that once a person is baptized, a person is fully initiated into the church, is fully a member of the body of Christ, the church then really emerges from the baptismal font. It's from the waters of baptism that the church emerges. And it's our belief that in baptism, God in Christ truly changes the person, that baptism is not merely something that the church does, for example, as some churches would say, to demonstrate faith or to give witness to faith that's already there, and in that way something that the person does as a public witness or a public testimony. But that, while that may be part of it, it is also the fact that in baptism we believe God truly claims the person forever, and makes the person part of the body of Christ, that the person truly is renewed in baptism.
Going forward in a new life and sort of letting go of the old one?
Going forward in a new life, letting go of the old one, or I would say in the case of children who are baptized not knowing what's happening to them, then it is incumbent upon the community that baptizes them to raise them in a culture that is born of this new life, so that this child grows up knowing what it is to live in a community that lives this new life in Christ. I think in many churches the notion is that ordination is what makes the church, that there are clergy people, and then the church sort of derives from their ordination. The church sort of catches on to a cleric, and that's what makes the church. And I think our understanding of church is the other way around, that what makes the church is our being joined to Christ in baptism, and then out of the baptismal community there arise many gifts and many functions, including the ordained ministries, which permanently set a person apart for service and leadership in the church. But that all comes out of the fact that first and foremost we are a community of baptized people who have been claimed by God, and who, because we have been claimed by God, make a commitment to live a certain way in the world, to live a certain way together, but also to live a certain way among those who are not of our number.
Yes, and to develop those gifts and abilities, which we can come back and talk a little bit more about as well. We're going to take just a short break now. We like to feature a piece of music each week on Godspeed, and this week's song is L'immensité du firmament, performed by Les Petits Chanteurs de Montigny. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. We are speaking with the Reverend Dr. Patrick Malloy, Professor of Liturgics at General Theological Seminary, the Episcopal Seminary of New York. Patrick, can you share a little bit about first of all, let's talk a little about your church, about Grace in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the kind of events that happened there and the growth that you saw there. And then I'd like to ask you a bit about your decision to then become a professor at General.
Well, I'm still the rector of Grace Allentown.
You are still director?
I'm still the rector of Grace Allentown. I'm sitting in my office at this very minute.
No
in Grace,
kidding.
Grace Allentown.
I thought you had accepted that position and that was your permanent shift.
It is. I'm doing double duty.
Double duty? My goodness.
So I am the professor of liturgy at General Seminary in New York City, and I am also still the rector of, which is to say, other traditions might use the word pastor,
yes.
The rector of Grace Church here in Allentown.
Oh, my gosh, that is a double blessing there.
Yes, it is.
Keeps you busy, I'm sure. Tell
yes,
us a little about the parish.
Well, you know,
how many years you've been rector there and what you've seen.
I'm in my ninth year here. Grace Church is a remarkable place. We are in the heart of Allentown. Allentown suffered great financial troubles with the death of the steel industry because our neighboring city of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, as you may know,
yeah.
was a major steel producing center. At one time, the Bethlehem steel plant in Bethlehem was the largest factory in the world. And when steel died here in the Lehigh Valley, the valley suffered greatly, and Allentown suffered greatly. And so these prosperous towns began to become poor. Grace Church is right downtown. So as you know, in most of cities that suffer this kind of fate, the downtown becomes the poorest part of the city.
Mm.
And so we are surrounded by, on the one hand, the government buildings and the art museum and the art school are just a block away, but blocks in other directions, there's a great deal of poverty, there's drugs, there's crime, there are all the things that plague inner cities, and therefore that don't plague the inner city church but call it to do something. And when all of this began to happen in Allentown, the people of Grace Church here, which is the oldest church in Allentown, the church longest in continuous use, this church was built in 1856, the people of Grace Church made a very conscious decision. It was not a passive decision. It didn't just happen. They made a conscious decision not to abandon the center city, while many other mainline churches did, and decided instead to make a difference. And that certainly happened long before I got here. I can take no credit for the spirit of social justice that lives in this place. Much of it is the result of the good work of my predecessor, Father Don Knapp, who had a great love, does have a great love for the poor, and instilled that in the people here. And so there was a prison ministry, and then there was a little food closet, and then there was this, and then there was that. And now this place is an enormous font of social justice initiatives. We have a very, very large food pantry now. Hundreds and hundreds of families are fed from here every month. Well, as you mentioned at the outset, we have GED, we have marriage enrichment, we have legal services, we have an employment office.
Hmm.
We have a Montessori school for needy children and are about to hopefully double the size of the building so that we can double the size of our student body. We've already added many, many additional grades during the time I've been here. We have just partnered with the Social Service Agency of the Diocese of Bethlehem. We are members of the Diocese of Bethlehem to turn a building next door to our church that we owned up until just this week. It used to be an AIDS ministry that we ran, but as you may know, the government does not provide the same level of funding to care for people with HIV and AIDS that it once did, and so we had to close our ministry, and then we had this empty building. But we have just partnered now with the Diocese of Bethlehem to convert it into a shelter for homeless people.
Mm.
So we are very concerned to be a light here in Center City Allentown, to let the light of Christ shine through us in Center City Allentown, and to make a real concrete difference, to do a liturgy here.
That's an amazing story. Two things come to mind. One, so many of the churches I have been in and worked in or been part of, if somebody homeless, struggling, came to the door, told us, I'm sorry, we, can't help you. And meanwhile, there's an enormous, space that can be used if we open our doors. And, of course, that's the big leap, isn't it, spiritually, not just personally in one's life, but as a corporate group, when do we just open our doors and do the right thing? And also the question, are the programs funded at all, or are these largely volunteer? How is that working?
The money comes from many sources. We have many funding streams. First of all, there is simply the sweat equity that the parishioners put into these various ministries. But we are able to secure funds. I think we've shown ourselves to be very good stewards. And so many of the philanthropic foundations in our area, in the Lehigh Valley, are willing to be quite generous with us because they know that we are good stewards and we do good things for this valley.
Mm-hmm.
Especially through our school and through our food bank, we are able to secure government funding.
Oh, that's great.
We have private donors who give us money. We're a very small group of people. Our average Sunday attendance is about 55. 55. So, and that's essentially the parish. I mean, it's not as if there are hundreds and hundreds of people on the books and 55 show up. We are a very small group. I think
I know those churches too.
Yes. I think if you were to include, you know, people who are at college, people who are in the military, people who are in nursing homes, people who simply can't come to church, we probably at this point are about 75 total.
Right.
And on any given Sunday, we get about 55, which is essentially everybody who lives here. So it's a very devoted group of people, and devoted to the entire life of the place, and are coming together on Sunday, and the works that we do together are not separate things. They are intimately linked to one another, so that our liturgy is a reflection of our mission, and our mission is a reflection of what we do in our liturgy. An interesting thing, within the last year, we've completely renovated our liturgical space, and a decision was made to put into the space chairs rather than pews, for many reasons. One, because our liturgy is quite varied, and we move around the room. It's an ambulatory kind of liturgy, and so it works much better if we can rearrange the furniture a bit. But also, we knew that if we had chairs, we could remove those chairs and use the space for other needs. And no more than a month after we had finished the renovation, which we did almost entirely ourselves, an apartment building just a block from here burned to the ground, and we offered our church to the Red Cross to make it the homeless shelter for the people who were burned out.
Hmm.
So that, and then a photograph of that appeared in one of our National Episcopal magazines. But I think that that's another example for us of how, while we can draw a sort of an intellectual distinction between the liturgy we do on Sunday and the liturgy of our lives,
right.
On the other hand, even the space, even in our imagining of the space, we imagined that these two things are intimately linked.
Yes, and that perhaps a sacred space or living our life out in a sacred way, it doesn't have to be reserved to this one particular building for an hour on Sunday, but goes with us wherever we go.
Yes, and conversely, that the sacred use of this building does not necessarily mean only used for nice church services.
Right. Right. Now, after all this is going on in your week at the parish, then you go, let's say you go to the seminary and you're teaching now on liturgics. And how does that translate? What do you bring now to the seminary courses, let's say, from your experience? What does that look like to you now?
I live at the seminary full time.
New minds.
Yes, I live at the seminary full time. I'm at Grace only part time now. I'm a part time rector. And that's possible because the people here at Grace Church are so invested in the work that they really don't need me here all the time. So that they're able to keep things going. Others than me are able to keep things going during the week. And I'm here for, you know, special occasions and for the weekends. When I am at the seminary, I think that what this does for my ability to teach aspiring priests is that I can teach liturgy in a more holistic way, I think. I can teach it not as a script to be followed or certain odd gestures and rituals to perform, but as an integral part of what it is to be the leader of a Christian community, that it is integral to being a Christian community. I suspect it brings a kind of an earthiness to what I do. In the seminary, because I have many concrete examples to draw on of how the liturgy here that we celebrate here at Grace has given birth to a great many social initiatives, and how the social initiatives that we are part of feed back then into our liturgy on Sunday. So I think this place keeps my feet on the ground.
How at the seminary do you have many students these days? Is it popular at this time for younger people to be entering into the church, or are you finding there's more issues to rebel about?
I am startled by how young our seminarians are.
Really?
Now, that is not to say that there are not people my age who is in their second careers have decided to pursue priesthood.
Right.
But I think not too long ago, most of those people who are pursuing priesthood were second career people or older people. That is increasingly, I am finding, not true. Certainly it's not true at General Seminary, and I hear that it is true across the seminaries of the Episcopal Church. We had one seminarian who came to General and turned 21 there. this year.
Oh, my.
But many of my students are in their mid to late 20s. I think that increasingly the student bodies that we see are young people. So for whatever reason, and I'm delighted, that we're doing something, at least in some places, because General draws from across the United States.
Right.
We are doing something, at least in some places, that seems to more and more quite young people worth the gift of their life. So I'm very heartened by it, actually.
Yes, and especially since we hear how difficult it is, you know, to be finding, let's say, you know, new priests, for example, in the Roman Catholic Church. It is inspiring to hear that there are younger people showing up, because that is the age. It's that age between 17 and 22 where all the questing is really peaking for young people, you know, emotionally, physically, spiritually. It's a great age of their spiritual quest, and most who decide to go in, you know, to do a lifelong, say, profession or seek holy orders, tend to be interested at that age. So you're right on track there with that one. And I'm wondering if it's the social role of the church that's inspiring them, because they're seeing the church as an agent of change. What have you heard in the classrooms?
Well, I suspect that I know that among many of them, they are not interested in a religion that does not have any impact upon the society. But I do want to say, though, and again, I find this to be extremely encouraging, that these are not people who really want to be social workers and think that they could be more productive if they had collars around their necks. I find there's a great interest in the interior life. A great faith, a great interest in personal prayer, and in striving to be honest, and in that, I suspect, a striving to be vulnerable before the holy. So there is indeed, I think, within them a desire to change the world. But I think equally there is a desire to change the world for the sake of the God they have come to know in Christ and the Christ they have come to know in this church. So I find the whole thing to be remarkably holistic and remarkably encouraging.
And there seems to be a contemplative factor there as well, getting in touch with the spiritual core of their being while, you know, aiming to work for, you know, outwardly in the community.
Yeah.
This is all very interesting to me, and I'm wondering also, do young seminarians today have different ideas or thoughts? Are they bringing you things that are quite different from what you thought when you were in seminary?
Well, it's a different world. And so I think they have different thoughts only because they're moving into a different world. What I think is consistent, though, is they want to confront the world that I am finding. They want to confront the world that really exists, not a world that did exist at a previous time. And so I think that while I suspect if we could go back in time and listen to the issues that people of my generation were concerned about, certainly the issues that these young people are concerned about are different issues because it's a different culture. And the church is different today, too. You know, for example, I suspect that as I told you, I did most of my formation in the Roman Church. But if I had been an Episcopalian when I was young, I suspect that we would have been talking about the ordination of women, for example, as being an issue that has a theological import, but also oftentimes it's couched in justice terms. That's simply not a question for us anymore.
Right.
And so the questions have shifted necessarily. But what I don't think has changed is the level of integrity, the level of energy, the level of commitment to dealing with the world as the world really exists. And I don't think that simply means the social ills in the world. I think
right.
It also means the spiritual hunger in the world. You know,
right.
How is it that we make attractive to people what we know to be good? Not because we think that there's anything wrong with those people, but because we believe that we have something that is so good that there are many people who need it, and therefore we ask the question, these young people ask the question, how realistically do we enflesh this in our day so that the gospel is attractive.
Yes. Well, you know, Mother Teresa was asked toward the end of her life, you know, how is it that she could be working in so much poverty for so long, and you know, the people and the, you know, the terrible physical poverty that they were living in. And her reply had more to do with, well, these people are happy and have great faith. And her concern was much more for the spiritual poverty of those of us in the West.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, coming, of course, from materialism and such. And this different world that we're talking about right now, one of the enormous changes, of course, is communication and how we communicate and how high-tech it is now and how instant it is now in the form of, you know, texting, constant images, constant flow of information, not necessarily knowledge or wisdom or context, but constant technology in our world, probably in some way bringing about an odd kind of isolation.
Yes.
Among people. Are the young seminarians plugged into that right now, about the isolation that can come from, you know, basically living at your computer 8 hours a day?
I have to say that I haven't spoken to them about it. I can tell you, though, that they're all children of their generation. And, I want to say clearly, they're not all in their 20s. I mean, we do have some people of, you know, of a certain age who are at General 2, and I certainly do not wish in any way to suggest that their vocations are not equally as valid. But I do find it to be exciting that there's so many young people, that we are appealing to people who are very young. But I know that those people are they're children of their age. And so I look out at my classroom and I see a sea full of glowing apples, you know, coming, looking back at me, you know. And they all have far more sophisticated telephones than I do. Mm. And they tweet and they Facebook and they do all of that. And I do know that they use a great deal of that technology for the sake of the mission that they think is theirs, in creative ways. Whether or not they see these various media and these various forms of technology as isolating, I have to admit that's not a conversation I've had with them, but certainly it would be a conversation worth having.
Yes, and you know, the internet has played a great role as well in informing people about churches. We can go online and do our research, and I'm sure they're enjoying that as well. I love the General Seminary of New York. I went there, actually. I interviewed there because I was a student at Mary Knoll, and Mary Knoll unfortunately was forced to close in the middle of my degree. And so I was interviewing around to, you know, for places to complete it, and I went to General. At the time, it was Bishop Anderson.
Yes.
There, and he was great. You know, it was terrific. And I decided at the time actually to complete my studies at Fordham. Yeah, another great place. The Jesuits of Fordham University. And I, you know, I enjoyed that very much. It was tough, but the Episcopal Seminary, of course, is this beautiful place in the middle of New York City, you know, like a medieval oasis, as it were. It's a beautiful church, beautiful gardens, beautiful place for people to be, and then, you know, surrounded by this diverse place around it. The great big city with all its strife and challenges and diversity, what is the role of the seminary in the community then?
Oh, well, you know, that is a very good question. We all live there, you know. Most of us do anyway. All the faculty but one live on the campus. Most of the students live on the campus. We have an increasingly large commuter group, but most of us live there. The seminary is now making great efforts to try to expand our student base so that we make available the resources of General Seminary for those who are not resident on that one big block there in Chelsea. The students at General have a clothes closet for the poor and homeless who are near us. A homeless shelter they volunteer at various social service agencies that surround us. They have internships at parishes in New York that do major outreach work. I'm thinking, for example, of our nearest parish, the Church of the Holy Apostles, that has perhaps one of the, if not the largest, feeding program in the United States. So the seminary, I think, makes an impact in those kinds of ways. We have an extremely large and diverse AA groups that use our campus for meeting. So in those ways, I think that the seminary has programs, but I think probably more significantly, the seminary puts students in New York City. And simply by doing their seminary work in New York City, the students come to appreciate the great social ills of our time and the great social possibilities of a great city that they might not if they were in a seminary that wasn't so urban as we are.
Right.
So I think that's I think that is a great contribution that we make. Because our seminarians come from all over the country, and from all over the world for that matter, many of whom have never before been to New York City, let alone lived in it. So for many, it's a transformative experience.
Right. A different kind of baptism, perhaps.
Yes, a different kind.
We have a couple of minutes left before we close, and I just wanted to ask you just for some final thoughts and comments on your particular priorities, what your hope might be for the church in the future, not just the Episcopal Church, but the church at large, and your vision of what that might look like in the years to come.
I think that we have great practical gifts to give the world. That is to say, I believe that all of the things that you and I have talked about that we have here, for example, at Grace Church in Allentown, or that the students at General Seminary are trying to both find and enact in New York City, I think all of that is extremely important. I think it models for the world a vision of what the kingdom is that God is bringing forth. And I think that is crucial. At the same time, I think that we are the bearers of vital tradition. I think that the story of Jesus is a true story. I think these days, as we look in our church at the last days of Jesus' life and at his glorification after his death, I think that I see in that story a story of how the universe really works, of what is good and what is God. And I think that I envision a church that holds fast to the inheritance that we have received, not as a kind of an anchor, not as a kind of a burden, but as an anchor and as a gift that opens a window for us into what divinity really is like. If we could see God, I think we have a window into what that might be like in the story of Jesus. And I think it's crucial for us to hold fast to that story and to give it to a generation, to a world that is looking for stories so they can make sense of an otherwise nonsensical world. So my hope is that we can both do the works of justice and be true to the inheritance that we have received. And I think if we can do those things, the church in the future will be vital and exciting and appealing to people.
Thank you very much, Patrick. By the way, before we close, where can people find more information about the Episcopal Church and GTS and perhaps your own books? Where can we send people to follow up for more information?
Well, a good place to start for the Episcopal Church is to go to the Episcopal Church website, which is ECUSA, that's Episcopal Church USA, ecusa.anglican.org, which will bring you to our national website. The website at general is gts.edu, and there you can find out all sorts of things about me if you just go to the faculty section and look me up. The parish website is Grace Allentown, all one word, GRACEALLENTOWN.com, and there you'll see all about our ministries and our liturgy and our common life, and there you'll find things out about me too, because all of my sermons eventually end up there.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Malloy. There's so much to discuss. Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
I would be delighted.
Thank you. And
thank you,
listeners, for joining us joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. We'll be back next week for another spiritual journey. And until then, Godspeed.